This podcast was recorded at the 2018 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference in Hollywood, Florida. To review the CE information and learn how to earn credit for JADPRO Live podcast activities, see the presentation material, or seek other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
Welcome back, everyone. Our next session is on a topic that is at the top of our mind in this field, CAR T cell therapy and the pharmacology of managing cytokine release syndrome. Please welcome our wonderful speakers, Dr. Jay Park and Dr. Amber King, both of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center.
All righty. So thank you for inviting us to give a talk. So we're both from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. So we'll be talking about, I'll be doing the first half of the talk and talk about a little background and clinical information about the CAR T cell therapy in ALL and large cell lymphoma. And then Amber will then talk a little bit about how to manage some of the side effects that we often see associated with the CAR T cells. All right. This. So these are the learning objectives. So hopefully by the end of the session, so we can identify and hopefully I can highlight the how to identify those patients who meet the criteria as candidate for CAR T cell therapy, consideration for their efficacy, and then the side effects. As much as it works really well, and it may not be for everybody. And then the second objective is devise strategies to mitigate cytokine release syndrome and other side effects associated with the CAR T cells. So the first to start off, what is CAR, and you guys may all be familiar with it, at least you guys have all heard about it. Now they're approved therapy, FDA-approved therapy. There are two approved therapies for CAR T-cell therapy for ALL and DLBCL. So what CAR is the combination of an antibody and then the T-cell receptor. So you can see here, the first part of the CAR T-cell therapy, the CAR T-cell construct comes from a binding domain from an antibody. So this is what we call single chain variable domain. So you kind of link them together, heavy and light chain, into a single chain like this. And then you connect the head of an antibody to a body of a T-cell receptor. So the body that's embedded in the transmembrane domain here, and then the cytosolic domain here, the T-cell signaling domain. So these are now combined to the antibody. So in a way, what it allows us to do is that it has a specificity of an antibody target recognition, just the same way that any antibody is targeting tumor antigens on anything that's expressed in cell surface, but it acts like the T cells. So it combines the advantage of the both cellular or the immunotherapy. So how do we really move the CAR T cell therapy into clinics and then make it successful as a cancer therapy? So this is a simple structure or the very simplified schema of a CAR T cell as we talked about. Again, the binding domain from an antibody against a specific tumor antigen and then the T cell receptor body. Once you create the construct, then you have to insert the CAR into, CAR stands for chimeric antigen receptor, into a T cell. And then the T cells can come from either the patients or the other allogeneic donors too. We'll talk a little bit about them, but the most commonly is coming from the patient themselves. So how do we insert the CAR into to the patient's own T cells is that we use a replication incompetent either retro or lentivirus. So these viruses then carry, really acting as a vector, a carrier to carry the genes as the DNA replicates of the patient's own T cells. Some of these T cells would then taken into the retroviral DNA. So any T cell DNA that has taken into retroviral DNA, all the progenies of those subsequent T-cell expansion will carry the CAR that you want them to. So you then select out those CAR T-cells that you want, then you infuse the T-cells back into the patient. And once they're in the patient's body again, these CAR T-cells then traffic to the site of the tumor because now they are equipped with this CAR that's against specific tumor antigen and then start eradicating the tumor cells. So that's really the basic concept of the CAR T-cell therapy. So in reality, how that it works is that we take the T-cells from the patient. In a cellular manufacturing process, there is what's called cell culture, or the activation happens. So this whole process can take about 7 to 14 days. It really varies depending on the manufacturing process and how you are modifying them, either the retro or the lentivirus. So once these cells are made, or they can either be infused fresh or more commonly cryopreserved. So they are frozen, and then they ship to the site of the clinic where the patients are being treated. And then once they arrive at the site, they're thawed at either at the bedside or the cell therapy center, and then infused back into the patient. So this is what we call vein to vein time. So one factor to really consider is that they are not readily available like any other drugs that we have. So it's not quite off the shelf, at least in the approved way now. So that this whole process, even though the manufacturing can take about 7 to 14 days, there's a pre-collection and there's a quality control that needs to happen after to make sure these cells are clean, are not contaminated, also viable. And then this can take about 3 weeks on average, or up to 4 to 5 weeks in some cases, which implies that in some of these patients, some patients may not even survive that long enough to allow the T-cell infusion. So that's kind of the first factor to consider. Is this really the right patient who are able to at least survive through the process by 4 week period of time to receive the T-cells? And during the same manufacturing process, the patients are able to receive some chemotherapy or any therapy to stabilize their disease. But some of these patients, if they're really, really refractory to all the lines of a therapy, you may not have a lot of options to control the disease, and those may not be the best patients to be treated with the CAR T cells. So why do we actually have to create this CAR and go out of the way to create the combination of these two from the antibody and the T cell receptor? What it allows us to do is an HLA-independent antigen recognition. So T cell receptor, the native T cell receptor T cells generally have, is that they require specific HLA type for the antigen to be processed and then be presented to the T cells, and that's how T cells recognize them. But the HLA is very specific to the patient themselves or the people themselves. So the antibody is universal, so you don't really have to consider the HLA. Anything that's expressed in cell surface, you can target them. So the universal application of applicability is what really the one benefit of the CAR T cell therapy. So any target in the cell surface can be targeted. In the rapid generation tumor-specific T cells, and when we say rapid, again, it's about 7 to 14 days, so depending how you look at it, it could be fast, and 14 days into longer, it's getting better and better, so there are some ways that the cell manufacturing may take even less than 7 days. And these T cells, because they're coming from patient themselves, and there's really very little risk of graft-versus-host disease as opposed to allogeneic, the stem cell transplant, which is really the biggest side effects of that is the graft-versus-host disease. And that the biggest potential, the reason that we are excited about the CAR T cell therapy, even though we still need to modify and there's work to do, is a living drug. It's a potential for the lasting immunity. So as opposed to antibody or antibody-drug conjugate, that you need to continuously administer these drugs to really get the most benefit from this therapy, the cellular therapy is just kind of the one-shot deal in a way, as we're kind of envisioning, is the one single cell infusion, the CAR T cells can generate, once they're in the patient's body, they can replicate, they can expand, usually 1,000-fold, 10,000-fold, sometimes even 1,000,000-fold expansion, and they last to provide a long-lasting immunity. Now, it's not always successful that way, that some of these patients are able to get the maximum benefit and are alive after 5 years, and these are the ones that we often hear about and generate a lot of excitement and the potential that the cell infusion can be a kind of the one-time and then the living drug that continues to replicate it. The tumor cells arise, T cells arise at the same time too, and they kill the tumor cells again and go into quiescent state, and they replicate the stage to provide a long-lasting immunity. That's really the holy grail, the kind of where this kind of biggest potential of the cellular therapy is, and there's kind of what we are working toward to that. So where this CAR T-cell therapy are currently being used as a cancer therapy is a CD19 is really the best target for the B-cell malignancies. So any B-cell malignancy, so ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or the lymphomas, a lot of B-cell lymphomas, will then have the CD19 is universally expressed on all stages of the B-cell maturation, including the BLL and again the B-cell lymphomas. So, and then as opposed to CD22 and CD20, which are also expressed in some of the BLL patients may not express CD20 and CD20 as opposed to 19. But importantly, it's not expressed in hematopoietic stem cells. So the factor to consider is that these CAR T-cell therapy, because they are very potent and they can expand 10,000 times kind of once in the patient's body, and they're much more potent than antibody therapy, if they were to work really well and survive long term, if they target really vital cells, then we're in a big trouble. So it is very important that they are not expressed in hematopoietic stem cells, so we don't have to worry about eradicating or ablating the stem cells, and these patients do not need a subsequent bone marrow transplant to rescue them. So that's kind of the big factors to consider. The selective expression of the target is really the key to make the CAR T cell therapy as a success. So the CAR T-cell CARs have come in many generations. So this is kind of the first generation they came about. It's a really the very simple the antibody or the body of a T-cell receptor that didn't really work quite well. And then the second generation, which is kind of the, what we will be talking about most of the time, and these are what's in clinic now, is the same as the first generation, but there's one additional component to it, which is a co-stimulatory domain of a CD28 or 4-1BB. So this is what's called signal 2. It's a T-cell receptor, so T-cells need a signal 1, which is the antigen recognition. That's the very first step. The T-cells require to be activated. It needs to recognize the antigen, but that's not enough. If that's all they get, and they get exhausted, they get anergic very quickly. So they need a signal 2 to excite them even more, that these are real tumor antigens. We really need to be activated, so signal 2 needs to be provided. But a lot of tumor cells get smart, and they don't express a signal 2 ligand for to activate the T-cells. So what these second generation CAR T-cells have is that they, within them, even if the tumor cells do not express a signal 2 ligand, CD80, for example, and 4-1BB ligand, they express a signal in itself, so they can activate themselves once it's recognized by the signal 1 of the antigen. So that's really the biggest potential. So where we are with the timeline of the clinical development. So MSK was actually, and it's probably not well-known fact, it's the first site to ever treat a the patient's oncological patient with a CAR T-cell therapy. So the first CLL patients were treated at MSK, and that was in 2007. So it's about 10 years ago is when it actually, the journey actually began. So after that, and then subsequently the other disease process, other B-cell malignancies that we're doing about, and then ALL patients, and the lymphoma patients, and follicular lymphoma patients. And then it took about 7 years until we actually really got the phase one clinical trials in ALL and a non-Hodgkin lymphoma to really get the process going. So we'll first talk about the CAR T-cell therapy in ALL first. So this is just to provide that not everybody may be treating adult ALL patients, adult leukemia patients. So these are very, very poor prognostic group of patients. So this is a really outcome of a relapse ALL in adults with a chemotherapy alone. So the graph on the left is showing the one of the largest data from the MRC, the UK, and then the US data, showing that if your first line chemotherapy fails, you have less than 10% chance of a long-term survival. And then the second curve on the right is showing another French, the European data showing very similar outcome. So the relapse patients, even if it's their very first relapse, they don't do quite well. And there's a huge need for these patients to improve their survival rate. So where we are with the CAR T-cell therapy in adult patients with an ALL and how we're really improving the outcome is that this is a phase one clinical trial that we conducted at MSK using one of the second generation CAR T-cells targeting CD19, that's where the 19 comes from. And then we have a CD28 as a co-stim domain, and we talk about the second generation CAR and the one of the signal. And then what we are using at MSK is predominantly CD28. Others have used it for 4-1BB, and I'll share those data as well. So that's why it's called 1928. Z is actually the signaling domain, the zeta chain. So 1928Z CAR T cells in relapse refractory ALL at MSK, and this is a study outcome that we published earlier this year, our long-term outcome. So with the chemotherapy in this patient population, I don't have a table to show you, but it's about 20% CR, which we'll get excited about. The complete response is what's expected from conventional chemotherapy. But in this data that we are seeing, CR rate about 85%, which is significantly higher than we have anticipated in seeing with the chemotherapy alone. And this is replicated across all different CAR T-cell trials in ALL. And in this data of 80% CR rate is actually what generated the initial excitement of the CAR T-cell therapy several years ago. That's probably when we all start to hear about, you know, what's really the potential. This has a true promise as a kind of very encouraging therapeutic options for these patients. And this is a really small, but this just shows you that there are a variety of the subgroups that we have looked at, the patients with a very large or small disease burden, or the patients where there are a lot of prior lines of a therapy. And as you can see here, the most of the patients had at least 3 or 4 prior lines of a therapy, meaning these are really super refractory patients to the conventional treatment. Regardless of that and age groups, all groups really benefited from the CAR T-cell therapy with the 80% complete response rate. Now, this is a long-term outcome that we saw with those. And then we already showed you the 80% complete response rate. But when you actually look at the survival curve, that you can kind of, there are a couple points to point out. The one is that it's not as good as that we hope to be. Even though that we have a long-term survival, the median follow-up is about 30 months in this patient population. And we have certainly room to improve. Because despite the 80% complete response rate initially, there are early relapses that do happen in these patients. So we need to watch out for these patients very carefully. So it's really too early to celebrate until about 6 months after. If you don't really relapse on the first 6 or 8 months, your chance of relapse after that is significantly low. But what's really exciting in this patient population is, again, these are the patients that we don't expect them to survive long term beyond 1 or 1 year. So these are the dismal prognosis patients. But we can see the patients surviving beyond 5 years. So this is kind of going above kind of 60 month kind of the altogether. So this is what is also generating excitement in a way that even though that there are early relapses, there are long-lasting responses these patients do experience. And what we need to really work on is how can we improve the response rate. So in this very same study, we also looked at what are the factors that determine the really the best success of a therapy. And then we looked at a bunch of different factors, their disease characteristics, their cytogenetics, molecular status, age, prior lines of a therapy. But the regardless of what it is, what really came out to be the best predictor of their long-term response is their disease burden. So the lower the disease burden that you have, in ALL patients, we define them as less than 5% leukemia cells in their bone marrow, the better the outcome this patient's got. So the low disease burden patients, which is the curve on the red box there, is significantly better than the high disease burden patients. Almost all high disease burden patients eventually relapse and then unfortunately succumb to the disease, but it's really the low disease burden patients who are really enjoying the kind of long-term benefit. So why that may be the case is kind of one thing that we're continuing to work on MSK to try to find out what really separate out the good responders and then the not so good responders. And there are a lot of factors to consider. T cell quality for these patients are different. And the one other thing is that low disease burden patients, they have a better control of the disease at the time of a T cell therapy. And that's kind of the one factor that we're trying to emphasize, at least in adult ALL patients populations, to think about who's really the best fit for the CAR T cell therapy. When we think about the referral to the centers who are really delivering this CAR T cell therapy, really the not the best patients are the ones with a rapidly progressive disease, and those are really very difficult to get onto the CAR T cell therapy trial or even the commercial therapy because it's very hard to pick a time to collect the T cells and wait for the 3 to 4 weeks of a T cell manufacturing process when the disease is taking off so quickly. So the really the best populations that somewhat stable disease, they could have a high burden disease, but stable disease is really the key at the time of a T cell infusion to get the best benefit. And of course, the lower the disease burden is the better as well. And we think it's really driven by the better effective to target ratio, meaning these patients get the same number of CAR T cells, but if you have a low disease burden, there's much more T cells compared relative to the amount of the tumor cells, and the favorable effective to target ratio may be what's driving the benefit of these low disease burden patients. So we share about the data at MSK that we have done, but what about the other centers? So this is a T-cell-genic Lucel, so which is the Novartis compound that used to be called CTL-019, that was originally conducted at CHOP in Philadelphia, and then now it was a global study, and this is a global study result in children and young adults with a relapsed refractory B-ALL. So what I just shared with you, in our data with the adult patients 18 and older, and this was up to the age of 25. So again, this is a 25 global study, and the 92 patients enrolled and 75 patients were treated, and then the T cell dose and then the design was pretty similar. And this is a survival curve from the data. Then you can see this is already better than kind of what we are seeing with adult patients. And the one thing to keep in mind, and I'll show you kind of the data overall at the other centers too, the pediatric ALL patients, unfortunately, tend to do much better than adult patients too. And so even the less refractory patients, when they get it, the disease is very different. So not only the age of these patients and tolerability of the therapy and then ability to go through the side effects, but their disease itself is actually better responding to any therapy they do get. So that's kind of what's driving the differences in the survival. But the same pattern emerges here too, the early relapses. So you can see about in the first 10 months or so, there's a continued decline of the curve, meaning there are relapses that happen during the first 10 months or so. But after that, if you don't relapse during the early point of the time, then your chance of relapse is very significantly lower because there's a long-term follow-up. This is holding true for the even longer follow-up now is that the responses are durable. So based on that result, and the response rate again in that study was about 80% as well. So this is what generated the first ever FDA-approved CAR T cell product that was done in August 2017 for treatment of the patients, but only up to age of 25, because that was really the data for this T cell-genic Lucel for the relapsed or refractory B-ALL. So we still do not have an approved CAR T product for adult patients older than 25. So 26 and older, all CAR T cell therapy is currently done in clinical trials for ALL patients. So this is the overall composite data of the clinical course after CD19 CAR T cells. Again, similar patterns. The pediatric ALL on the top panel there tend to do much better. In adult ALL study, there are fewer because it's a less it's much a rare disease in adults than in children. Even though they're better than what we expect them to conventional chemotherapy, they tend to do slightly worse than kind of what we expect in the pediatrics. And this is just composite data, just kind of to highlight that regardless of which CAR you use, which centers, which manufacturing process, is one thing. What's encouraging is a very consistent result, about 80% complete response rate, and similar relapse rate is about 40% in this patient population. So we'll move on to the DLBCL patients, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So we focus about an ALL. So they are now approved product for that too. So the first one is exicaptogene. So this is based on ZUMA-1 trial for the Kite Pharma. This is again showing 1928. So the construct is actually very similar to what we are using at MSK, targeting CD19 with a CD28 co-stim domain. So overall response rate in this also, again, heavily pretreated patient population was 82%. Now the 54% of this was a complete response and about 28% were partial response. And in ALL data, all the responses we're talking about really complete response. And partial response in ALL is really not that meaningful because almost all those patients will relapse. In DLBCL is a somewhat true as well, the aggressive large B-cell lymphoma is really the complete responders who do much better than the partial response. And this is kind of the curve that shows that the complete response, which is a green line on the left side of the curve there showing the best responses. And then the partial response, I mean, if you get more than 50% but not completely, those patients now tend to do very well too. So it's really these complete responders who do very well. But the relapse rate, even though they happen, they are less than what we get with ALL. So what's really quite interesting is that using the same number of CAR T cells, that we're getting a different response rate. So the complete response is about 50%, so lower than 80% that we see in ALL, but their relapse rate is slightly different. It's only about 30% or so, and it's very durable. So there are actually a lot of differences. So it really makes it very also difficult to interpret the data trial by trial too. So based on that, and I didn't share the data with the T-cell generated Lucel, which is the Novartis compound that we reviewed the data for pediatric ALL, they have resulted in a very similar data in adult patients with the DLBCL. So based on these two, the different clinical trials, so there are now two products. One is exicaptogene that's approved by Kite Pharma in October 2017 for relapse refractory large B-cell lymphoma after two prior lines of systemic therapy. And then there are some histologies that's really applicable, which is the DLBCL, not otherwise specified, primary a large B-cell lymphoma, high-grade B-cell lymphoma, and DLBCL that arise from follicular lymphoma. And the T-cell generated Lucel, which is a Novartis product, was subsequently approved in May of this year, 2018, for a very similar indication for this too. Then I'll kind of talk about, so where we are now is that now we have two approved products, one for both DLBCL and ALL, pediatric ALL, that's T-cell generated Lucel from Novartis, and then we have one approved product for large B-cell lymphoma, the exicaptogene. So this is quite exciting. So there's now more prospective clinical trials to kind of understand where the CAR T cells fit in as well. So we already talked about low burden disease, probably the best setting to do. It's really not best to do CAR T cell therapy, and which is also true for the large B-cell lymphoma, where the T cells are rapidly progressing. I mean, the tumors are rapidly progressing is really not the best setting to try for the CAR T cell therapy. So a lot of trials are now ongoing, trying to move this T cell therapy to earlier lines of a therapy too, rather than waiting until their fourth line of a therapy, trying to move them to as a first or second, the relapse line of the therapy. I won't go over too, I'm gonna, for the sake of the time, I'm gonna just talk about the toxicities a little bit because I think it's very important to kind of focus on. We talked a lot about the clinical efficacy, which is what generates excitement, but what we really do see day to day from the our nurses and then advanced practitioners who take care of these patients kind of hour to hour, minute to minute, is really the toxicity aspect of it. And that's kind of the where we spend a lot of time educating, and then our nurses and APPs have been really the greatest force kind of trying to establish a standard of a practice to how to manage and watch out for these symptoms. So there are two really main side effects that we do watch associated with the CD19 targeted CAR T cells. One is cytokine release syndrome, and the second is a neurotoxicity. So cytokine release syndrome, so abbreviated CRS, is really a result from a activation of the T cells. So in the clinical symptoms are really from the fever, hypotension. The hypotension fever could be very high to up to 40 degrees Celsius, 41 degrees Celsius. So these are, we're talking about very high degree of a fever that can last several days. 3 to 4 days of a 40 degrees Celsius will really exhaust our patients too. And then this is despite Tylenols and Motrin and other things that kind of you will do for these patients. So these are, even though it's a fever, some could be very mild, and there are very different degrees of a cytokine release syndrome too, but these are the factors to consider. Hypotension, and then again, it could be very mild and just mild, and the blood pressure is 90s or 50s that require 1 liter of bolus and it comes right up. But there are some patients that require 3 pressors need to go to ICU because it's very severe cytokine release syndrome. So it's a really just immune activation state, the body's response for the activation of the CAR T cells is very similar to flu-like illnesses. So when we just explain to the patients potential side effects they could get, we really just talk about this could be severe flu-like symptoms and in a different severity. Some could be very mild and some could be very severe. Respiratory insufficiency, the other things that we think about is that because of the capillary leak syndrome, these patients can get, especially if they get a lot of fluid boluses for their hypotension, they can also get hypoxic, increased respiratory rate, and some of these patients may also require intubation for this too. So again, those are very severe side effects, and these are rare patients to get them, but there's a whole range of the side effects that we have to think about. So when we see patients who start to get fevers, then we know that these are warning signs that this is the beginning of something that could get potentially worse. So these are the patients we decide to admit and to monitor more closely. And then rather than getting vitals checks every 6 hours or so, it's much more frequently. And then that's kind of depending on the nursing to patient ratio. Some of these patients may also need to be transferred to ICU, not necessarily because they need the pressors or intubation or special medications, but just simply for the amount of the care they require and the frequent check-in is simply sometimes hard to do often on the floor. The second is a neurotoxicity, which is a very unique, and it is something that we did not even know to expect when we were first treating patients with the CAR T-cell therapy. So now it's very well-recognized side effects, but when we were first trying these patients 10 years ago, treating these patients 10 years ago or 8 years ago, that we were not even expecting this. The first time we saw that we were not even sure what those were, whether these are side effects of the high fevers or delirium, or these are kind of distinct side effects. Now we do know that these are very much of a distinct side effect these patients do get. And then the symptoms can vary range from confusion disorder, orientation, which is really the first symptom they do get, and then they progress usually to aphasia, so difficulty speaking, stuttering, and not able to name objects. So these are really very sensitive testings that we do with a consultation with the neurology. That's really the hallmark of this neurotoxicity. It's not able to name the objects, and blank stare and stuttering is really kind of where they begin. Now they can stop there and spontaneously recover without any further intervention, or they can progress into the next symptoms, which is seizure or seizure-like activity or hallucinations. And then the severe case is a global encephalopathy and the comatose state, so unresponsiveness, and they're just kind of deep sleep and not able to arouse, and they can be sleeping for 3 days, 4 days, and not arousable during that time too. So now it sounds all scary, and then we'll talk about, I'm going to pass it along to Amber to say, what are we really trying to do to minimize the side effects too? But I do spend a good amount of time on the side effects with the patients too, because it's really important to really set the expectation from the very beginning. A lot of times the patients do come in and thinking this is going to be the great therapy, 80% response, a durable response. Of course, I want this therapy for my own self and then my disease too. But the one thing that we have to think about is that it's not so much the patients too, the caregivers that come with the patient. When they see the patients not able to speak, stuttering, not able to communicate, it could be very scary for them. So the more that we spend the time with them, these are the things that you can expect to see. We're hoping that you don't get any of the side effects. You may not get any, but if you do see, this is well-known side effects we expect them to see. These are the ways that we can manage them. We found those strategies being very helpful to kind of alleviate the anxiety that usually kind of comes with this type of a therapy too. So I'm going to talk briefly. I know I'm kind of running short, and I want to give Amber plenty of time to talk about her stuff too. So in the kind of the hopefully 3 to 5 minutes or so, what are the rates of these toxicities? We talk about CRS and the neurotoxicity, two common side effects associated with the CAR T-cell therapy. So CRS, all grades, is about 80% or so, meaning most patients will get some degree of a CRS. And these are just isolated fevers. It could be 38.5, 39, it could be 40, but a day or two. These are what we call mild or low-grade CRS. But what really need to focus on is the, what we really need to get concerned about is the severe CRS. Those are the ones who require ICU level of care for pressors or intubation. So the rate of those is about 26 or 25% overall for adult patients with ALL. And the DLBCL is a slightly less too. And the one thing to keep in mind is that this rate of these side effects are different based on the product themselves. So whether it is who's manufacturing them, the structure of the CAR T, how quickly the T cells get activated, the quicker the T cell activation, intuitively, the more likely you're gonna get and quickly to severe cytokine release syndrome. So once you know the characteristic of a CAR T cell expansion and 1928 in that aspect are the fast expander. So 1928 is one of the CAR T cell therapy. We think of it as a kind of the racing horse. As soon as the kind of the gate opens, they go really quickly, just go all the way out there. Within a couple of days, they can get 40 degrees of Celsius of fever right away. 1941BB is kind of more of a marathon runner. They get slow start, but they eventually get to the same place as 1928, but they get there slower. So because of that, the side effect profile may be a little bit somewhat more expected and slower too. And that is important distinctions too, because when you see a 40 degrees Celsius for one product that you know can get bad very quickly versus the other one, they may just stay there and you may have more time to intervene. The way, then what Amber's gonna talk about some of the other medications that we may not need to intervene or worry as much about them. So it's important to recognize that side effect, the rate really and severity depending on not only the CAR T cell product, but also the disease in itself too. Adult ALL patients tend to get the most degree of side effects too. They are the ones who get the highest rate of a complete response, but they're also the ones who get the most toxicity. DLBCL is slightly less, and pediatric ALL is also slightly less too, but the lymphoma patients, about 20% or so these patients will get. And I'll go over what are the ways that we can actually to CRS is the better the T cell expansion, the more the CRS and neurotoxicity, which implies that these side effects are somewhat associated with the CAR T cells. It's not so much the CAR T cell themselves that are directly responsible for these side effects. We actually don't know the mechanism quite well for the neurotoxicity, but they correlate with something about the T cell activation and the immune expansion is what's leading to these side effects. And these are some of the data to kind of to show that too. And the one key thing to inspect, which Amber will talk about, is that CRS, one of the hallmarks of a cytokine release syndrome, as the name implies, cytokine release syndrome. There are several cytokines that get elevated during that time, and interleukin-6 or IL-6 is just one of them, and then we have several IL-6 receptor or IL-6 inhibitor, which are used in and approved for this specific indication to prevent the CRS. So these are the things that Amber will talk about and how to manage them. So the key thing in managing this type of side effects is that early anticipation, who are the patients who are likely going to get this severe cytokine release syndrome? Again, adult ALL patients receiving 1928 is probably the most likely to get them. DLBCL patients with a 1941BB is less likely. And then higher the disease burden, also associated with the severe side effects too. And then that's kind of intuitive in a somewhat of a sense, the more disease you have, that's more antigen, and then the more chance for the T cells to activate. So even if you actually give a very little dose of a T cells, like 1 million as opposed to 3 or 30 million for the other low burden disease, even if you get a small disease burden, that antigen is so much, as soon as the T cells get infused into the patient's body, they immediately encounter the tumor cells and they get activated very quickly. So the more disease you have, more toxicity you're gonna get. But also, we talked about more disease are the ones who also get less durable response too. So that's another reason that we advocate that really the best patient population is not only for the side effects, but also the efficacy is really the low disease burden patients. This is just one slide to show the neurotoxicity. We don't know kind of what the mechanism is. We have done a lot of work in MSK and others. Fred Hutch in Seattle has done a lot of other great works there too. This is to show the time frame. The CRS and neurotoxicity, just to close it, is a transient reversible side effects. And as much as the terrible things that I just talked about and I talk with the patients, I usually end the conversation there that these are expected side effects, but that we know how to manage them. And there are a couple of different ways that we can manage them, and these are reversible side effects too. And there have been a few fatal cases, and these are rare events, but something for us to consider, and that's really all the more reasons to be vigilant for these side effects and intervene appropriate time point, but these are really the transient ones. So the timing for the CRS is usually the first week or so. If you really don't get it for the first 7 or 10 days after T-cell infusion, you're really not gonna get these side effects. Neurotoxicity comes slightly after, so where the orange is there in this curve is usually about the 7 days or so. So first neurotoxicity usually happens, the median time is day 9, First, fever median time is day 2. So meaning really immediately after T-cell infusion, we expect the fever to happen. Neurotoxicity really comes after. And they can last, depending on the degree of a neurotoxicity, for a few days to a few weeks too. So 2 weeks is probably the long period of time for this to last. So when they get last that long and then they're kind of not able to mobile, especially in a kind of very encephalopathic state, these patients also require some physical therapy to get better too. But again, the important point is that these are transient, even though it's a 3 to 4 week period of the time, and there's nothing lasting. So there's no chronic side effects that at least that we, as far as we know now, that we need to deal with, as opposed to graft-versus-host disease and other transplant-related symptoms too. So these are kind of intense side effects that we need to monitor really immediately after the T-cell infusion. But again, after beyond 3 to 4 weeks, if you don't get those, these are unlikely to happen for those patients. So with that, I'm going to give it to Amber to see how are you going to really manage this cytokine release syndrome and to prevent it from happening.
Thanks, Dr. Park. So as Dr. Park extensively mentioned, cytokine release syndrome is the most prevalent adverse effect following CAR T-cell therapy. CRS must be identified promptly using patient symptoms such as fever, rigors, or hypotension, and also lab changes in inflammatory markers such as C-reactive protein or ferritin or other sophisticated inflammation markers. Following the diagnosis, there's a delicate balance between mitigating this immune cascade while salvaging the efficacy of CAR T cells. The early recognition and optimization of supportive care should be consistent among all grades of CRS for your patients. It's important to employ strategies to maximize patient comfort and symptom relief. The first step is utilizing antipyretics. And the antipyretic of choice at our institution is acetaminophen, or Tylenol. Often we try to avoid things like NSAIDs, ibuprofen, just because persistent and high doses of these medications can lead to acute kidney injury, which in a critically ill patient can be ultimately devastating and add insult to injury. Secondly, these patients are hematologic malignancy patients that are immune suppressed. So a sign of fever is not only indicative of CRS, but could also be an overlapping infection. So it's essential that practitioners recognize this and cover your patients with broad-spectrum antibiotics. We employ broad-spectrum gram-negative coverage, covering for things like Pseudomonas and Klebsiella, along with radiographic studies and frequent vital sign checks for these patients. Finally, we conservatively use GCSF, or colony-stimulating growth factors. These inherently are cytokines in themselves and could exacerbate cytokine release syndrome. However, they can be essential and life-saving for a patient who's neutropenic and bacteremic. In addition with fevers, another big step in CRS is hypotension. As you can see, the management is very similar to that of a septic shock patient. So we usually start with fluid boluses of normal saline and use about a half liter to a liter. After failure of about 2 to 3 fluid boluses, our shift is escalation of care. On the right, you'll see a table of vasopressors and equivalents. We usually start with low-dose vasopressors plus or minus anti-IL-6 therapy, which we'll get into detail later, and see how a patient responds. Overall, a patient that requires high-dose vasopressors or multiple vasopressors should be strongly considered for anti-IL-6 or CRS-directed care management. Now we'll go into detail about the pharmacotherapy and CRS. By a show of hands, who's had to use tocilizumab for a patient? Okay, so there's a few of you. So we'll talk in detail about the science behind tocilizumab and what are some steps and just how to decide when to use it for a patient. So as Dr. Park extensively mentioned, there's a correlation between the severity of CRS, the peak of the CAR T cell levels in the blood, and the elevation of IL-6. IL-6 can signal in multiple different ways, but it's thought that the trans signaling is the pro-inflammatory component of IL-6. Tocilizumab is an IL-6 receptor antagonist. It's available as a subcutaneous or IV infusion. It's essential to note that when used for CRS, it should be used in the intravenous formulation only for reliable peak levels and quick onset of action for patients. It's FDA approved, and it's the only FDA approved agent for cytokine release syndrome for patients two years and above, and the CRS has to be deemed severe or life-threatening and secondary to CAR T-cell therapy. Tocilizumab binds to all IL-6 receptors, mitigating this downstream activation of inflammation. The serum IL-6 levels have also been shown to be displaced after tocilizumab utilization. At our institution, we have some early data that suggests that the use of tocilizumab may actually shift IL-6 levels into the CSF and could possibly increase risk of neurotoxicity. Now, this by no means precludes our use of tocilizumab for CRS, but there should be caution used when a patient has isolated neurotoxicity, as tocilizumab may not be that effective and can also add insult to injury to your patient. As far as administration, the dose is strictly capped at 800 milligrams, and it's weight-based. So if your patient's above 30 kilograms, the dose is 8 milligrams per kilogram. Patients less than 30 kilograms receives 12 milligrams per kilogram. It's a relatively quick infusion and can be given via central or peripheral access. If no clinical improvement of a patient is established, you have the ability to redose tocilizumab. There has to be a minimum of an 8-hour interval between doses, and the recommendation is to cap at 4 doses of tocilizumab. An extremely important admin component is that if your institution utilizes commercial CAR T-cell products, patients must have 2 vials of tocilizumab on site. As far as kinetics, tocilizumab has been demonstrated to be efficacious and has a quick onset of action. In the retrospective trials, which we'll touch upon in a few minutes, the median time to defervescence was approximately 4 hours, and hypotension tends to resolve within the next few hours. You'll see a lot of recommendations for renal and hepatic adjustments, but our current practice and the recommendation is to give patients full unattenuated doses of tocilizumab to give them the best chance at efficacy. Often in CRS, the organ dysfunction is present. It may not be secondary to drug, but actually due to the CRS itself. Finally, a theoretical risk is drug-drug interactions. During cytokine release, they're thought to be blockade of CYP enzymes, enzymes important for metabolism of a lot of drugs during CRS. There's a theoretical risk that you can experience increased drug levels of sensitive substrates like voriconazole, prosaconazole, or a lot of other medications. Fortunately, the function of CYP enzymes is thought to be restored after tocilizumab. So our current practice is to not do any empiric dose adjustments, but to consider therapeutic drug monitoring levels for sensitive substrates to make sure your patients are either underdosed or overdosed for medications. As far as the adverse effect profile in tocilizumab, it's important to establish that there's 2 different profiles. There's adverse effect profiles for the non-CRS population, which you'll see before you, and on the right, there's adverse effects profiles for the CRS population. In the retrospective analyses that got tocilizumab the FDA approval, there were no adverse effects that were independently associated with tocilizumab therapy. And these lack of differences were seen in both the pediatric and adult patient population. So it's important to consider when you utilize tocilizumab, the benefit almost certainly always outweighs the risk. Next, we'll dive into the clinical evidence that established tocilizumab as an agent for CRS. There are pooled retrospective studies from the major CAR T-cell trials that Dr. Park spoke about previously. They included 60 patients that were deemed to have severe or life-threatening CRS, and they evaluated patients for CRS resolution. Now, CRS resolution was defined as the absence of fever and the absence of vasopressors for at least 24 hours. In the intervention group, you can see it's the FDA-approved doses of tocilizumab at 8 milligrams per kilogram or 12 milligrams per kilogram based on adult or pediatric dosing. As far as demographics, you can see the characteristics of the patients. The CTL019 CAR T cells were the younger group with all B cell ALL, and the KTCC19 CAR T cells were our adult patients with diffuse large B cell lymphoma. Majority of the patients had severe life-threatening CRS, and a decent amount had CRS that persisted for 4+ days. Most patients received only 1 dose of tocilizumab. As far as efficacy results, you can see the impressive response of tocilizumab. Remember, these patients were severely ill, life-threatening CRS in the intensive care unit, and over 68% of them responded by day 14, most receiving only 1 dose of tocilizumab. As far as safety, again, it's important to harp on that no adverse reactions attributable to tocilizumab were seen. Overall, because of the patient population, there were 5 deaths seen within each group after the first 30 days of tocilizumab, but this was attributed to disease progression and critical illness. Finally, the kinetic data in these studies supported the safety of dosing, with up to 4 doses given 8 hours apart, which is now in the FDA-labeled recommendations. Whenever we talk about abrogating inflammation, there's always a theoretical concern that we're actually harming the efficacy of CAR T cells. Fortunately, tocilizumab has not been demonstrated to blunt efficacy of CAR T-cell therapy, and there are some early studies to try to officially establish this fact. In the AxiCell trial, which garnered the FDA approval for adults diffuse large B-cell CAR T-cells, there were no differences in overall response rates between TOCI users and non-TOCI users. So to summarize the evidence for tocilizumab, it's the only FDA-approved agent for CRS management, and it's strongly recommended for patients with grade 2 or beyond CRS. This is CRS that's progressed beyond vasopressors, fluid boluses, and other supportive care management. The FDA approval was unconventional and based off of a retrospective series, but it's appropriate considering the rarity of these cases and the critically ill nature of this patient population. But it's always important to note that these studies were not directly powered to assess for efficacy or toxicity of tocilizumab. Fortunately, tocilizumab has not been demonstrated to diminish the efficacy of CAR T-cells based on the currently available data. Overall, more studies and real-world experience are needed to establish the true role and timing of tocilizumab therapy. Another IL-6 agent that's approved on the market is cetuximab. Cetuximab is an antagonist of interleukin-6. Think back to tocilizumab. It's an antagonist at the receptor of IL-6. Cetuximab is available as an intravenous solution only, but it's extremely important to note that the use is restricted to expert opinion as a salvage therapy for CRS that's progressed beyond tocilizumab, glucocorticoids, and supportive care measures. Cetuximab, again, binds directly to IL-6, thus preventing IL-6 from activating all IL-6 receptors and leads to a net lowering of IL-6. As far as administration, the optimal dose in CRS, again, is unknown because cetuximab is in the infant stages of being used for CRS. The dosing, however, is based off of weight at 11 milligrams per kilogram, and the dosing is extrapolated from the FDA approval of Castleman's disease. It's a quick infusion of about 60 minutes, but it's important to note that it's short stable. So if at any point your institution decides to use this, there's a coordinated effort that must be established between admixing and administration. And again, since there's a lack of data in CRS, there's no data available regarding to the dosing intervals. So to summarize cetuximab, the routine first-line use is not generally recommended. There's overall just an absence of published data. The mechanism of action suggests less risk of an IL-6 flare that can, in theory, be seen with tocilizumab. Cetuximab should be considered for severe and refractory CRS that's failed after optimization of tocilizumab, glucocorticoids, or there's a concern for overlapping neurotoxicity. Further studies for cetuximab are being established to determine the true role of cetuximab in CRS management. Next, move on to the final and probably most controversial agent in the management of CRS, glucocorticoids. We're all familiar with the mechanism. Steroids tend to just fix everything. They decrease inflammation, they decrease transcription of interleukins, and also increase transcription of interleukin receptor antagonists, overall leading to a net degree of anti-inflammatory effects. Inherently, you can see the theoretical risk of using this medication, as glucocorticoids are directly lymphotoxic and can destroy T cells. Some technical difficulties here, guys. There we go. As far as glucocorticoids, there are two major agents that are recommended in guidelines, dexamethasone and methylprednisolone. Now, the choice of these agents depends on the institution you're working at, the clinical symptoms of the patient, and what expert opinion guideline you're looking at. But I'll list below for you the differences between the two agents. First is dexamethasone, which is our long-acting glucocorticoid. It has a half-life of about a day and a half to 3 days, and is overall 5 times the potency of methylprednisolone. It has partial metabolism in the CNS, thus giving it adequate CNS penetration. There's a proposed dosing strategy below before you, but by no means is this a strict recommendation. You should titrate the dose based on patient clinical scenario and symptoms. On the right, you'll see methylprednisolone, which is a shorter or intermediate-acting glucocorticoid. The half-life is shorter, which gives you the benefit of quickly tapering off and having the effects wear off. Compared to dexamethasone, however, it has poor CNS penetration, and there's a proposed dosing schema below before you. Overall, when the choice to use glucocorticoids in these patients is established, it's essential to make sure that you use the shortest amount of dose for the shortest amount of time, because we're unsure of how long-term steroids can adversely affect these CAR T cells. We're all familiar with the adverse effect profile of glucocorticoids, but there's some notable adverse effects for use in these patients that should be highlighted. Endocrine and metabolic effects, such as hyperglycemia, should be well controlled, especially for patients in the intensive care unit. There's a risk for GI hemorrhage and stress ulcers, so ensure your patients on adequate PPIs or stress ulcer prophylaxis. And finally, there's an increased risk for opportunistic infections, especially in this hematologic malignancy patient population. Patients should be on adequate fungal and PCP prophylaxis, especially when they're receiving therapy with glucocorticoids. So going back to our concern with efficacy for steroids, inherently steroids can diminish the expansion of T cells in a healthy patient. So there's a concern of using glucocorticoids with limiting the effectiveness of CAR T cells. So our practice and the expert opinion practice is to attempt to reserve steroids only for CRS that is refractory to supportive care and tocilizumab. There have been several attempts to establish the true nature of glucocorticoids. What's the dose, and how long is too long to be on these for these patients? In the AxiCell trial, the rates of overall response actually didn't differ between glucocorticoid users and non-glucocorticoid users. So to summarize glucocorticoids, they overall suppress an inflammatory response. They should be strongly considered for CRS that is refractory to tocilizumab. Dexamethasone and methylprednisolone have emerged as the glucocorticoids of choice. The dosing range in which agent to use is based on the grade of CRS and the concern for overlapping neurotoxicity. Some data suggests that corticosteroids may not actually mitigate response to CAR T cells. However, it's important to note that more prospective and controlled trials are needed to be established to elucidate this true effect of CAR T cells, of glucocorticoids on CAR T cells. So overall, due to the concern for decreased T-cell expansion and decreased efficacy, we use caution with routine glucocorticoid use in these patient population. Now that we've looked at all the agents that we can use for a cytokine release patient, we'll go through some case studies. And kind of the methodology behind this is what we would use at our practice and what a lot of the guidelines suggest should be used in sequence. So the first case is AK is a 24-year-old female with relapsed refractory B-ALL who is day 2 of anti-CD19 CAR T cells. The RN pages you with a high fever, Tmax of 101.3, and hypotension. The patient is fortunately ANO times 4 after exam. Which of the following is the most appropriate intervention for AK at this current time? You'll see below there's a host of different options, including supportive care, corticosteroids and vasopressors, tocilizumab, and dexamethasone and broad-spectrum antibiotics. But it's important to sequence these and reserve extreme therapies for patients who need it. The correct answer here is a fluid bolus, antipyretics, broad-spectrum antibiotics, blood cultures, and x-rays. This patient has new onset in grade 1 CRS or fevers. It's important to control her for infection, control her symptoms of fever, and ensure that she has enough fluid boluses on board to support any method of hypotension. You're called to the bedside about an hour after your previous intervention. AK is now persistently febrile with a lower blood pressure. The ICU is consulted, and the team decides to start low-dose vasopressors on the floor. Patient remains alert and oriented upon exam, but is visibly diaphoretic and is still febrile. Fortunately, the blood cultures return negative. Which agent is the most appropriate to consider at this time? So you'll see there's a choice of broadening antibiotics further, anti-IL-6 therapy with tocilizumab, glucocorticoids with dexamethasone, and finally, cetuximab. This patient has CRS that's progressed beyond supportive care measures and vasopressors, and so the next appropriate agent to employ at this time would be anti-IL-6 therapy with tocilizumab. Finally, AK symptoms resolve within 3 hours after receipt of tocilizumab. Unfortunately, she experiences a resurgence of febrile episodes and hypotension. She's transferred to the ICU for further management. After 3 more doses of tocilizumab and high-dose vasopressors, she remains hypotensive, febrile, and is now only minimally responsive. which agent is the most appropriate to consider at this time? So you'll notice the patient now has essentially grade 3, grade 4 severe CRS. She's already optimized supportive care. She's on vasopressors for blood pressure support, and she's essentially deemed refractory to anti-IL-6 therapy. This is the point where we consider glucocorticoids as our fail-safe option. So as far as future directions, there's a lot to be known about CRS. There's a role of discovering the prophylactic use of tocilizumab for at-risk patients, the true role of sultuximab for the prevention and or management of CRS, other inflammatory therapies. Finally, a formal consensus CRS guideline needs to be reached, sequencing agents, when to use them, and how to combine them if applicable.
So give the egg now. Thank you, Amber. There. So I think just in the last 1 minute, I think the one thing is that tocilizumab, as Amber pointed out, is really the IL-6 indicator is a standard therapy to manage the cytokine release syndrome. It doesn't really work very well for the neurotoxicity, so I think dexamethasone is a preferred therapy for patients either isolated neurotoxicity, which is not very common, or severe neurotoxicity. And then the last acknowledgement section, this is, as you can imagine, it's a very intense teamwork. So we started as a very from the leukemia service, from our first CLL and ALL patients, now the lymphoma patients, now the solid tumor CAR T patients in clinical trials. What we have realized is that it's really good to have a collaborative team from the different department services, a point person, one from the APP side, a nursing staff side, an ICU side, and a neurologist side, an infectious disease team. Having that really improved the quality of the care and then the communication that we need to have, and then also setting up some consensus guidelines. So what it is there's really no absolute kind of perfect way to manage these patients. A lot of it is what is indeed is a guideline, and this is what the Amber just kind of went over the questions. So what's also in the REMS, the therapy that each of these commercially approved product, because of the side effects, they are required to really complete kind of this training too. So these are some of the members that we're working with in MSK Center for Cell Engineering, where the cells are actually being manufactured, Cellular Therapeutic Center, where we are part of, where we actually cells are being administered and clinical care is given, and then the leukemia service, including the Ambers and the pharmacist, and of course the patients who have dedicated and participated in the clinical trial that allow us to kind of advance this therapy to clinics. And thank you for your attention too.